As the shots echo out in the early morning hours, multiple lives change in a single moment. The man sleeping in his bed a few kilometers away, though, has no idea. He will have the last peaceful sleep for many years to come that night. But as dawn breaks, everything will change. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 178, The Wrongful Conviction of Sibusiso Bulose. This episode is sponsored by Krypton Signs. You probably don't know this about me, but in my previous life, like pre-podcast, not pre-birth, I worked at a signage company for 12 years. Yeah, I'm one of those lifer employees. I still have a really soft spot for the signage industry, which I know sounds weird, but there's something about helping people to create one of the most important parts of branding for their business that feels like you're making a real difference. So when Krypton Signs wanted to come on board as a sponsor for the podcast, I thought that was a really cool full circle moment. If you're looking to make a bold statement with your business, Krypton Signs will bring your brand to life with custom signage that stands out. Whether you need eye-catching storefront signs, event banners, or vehicle wraps, they've got you covered. No job is too big or too small, and they deliver top quality results fast. Krypton Signs offers free consultations to help you design the perfect sign for your business. If you're ready to make your business impossible to ignore, visit the lovely folks over at Krypton Signs at www.kryptonsigns.co.za or call 069-409-7112 today for a free quote. That's Krypton Signs, your signage, your way. Call 069-409-7112 now and get started. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Charmaine Fenter, Zita Haralal, and Mersha Knutzer for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. I've covered two other wrongful conviction cases on the podcast before, and each time the episode is met with a reaction of complete horror from listeners that our justice system could so thoroughly mess up in the direction we'd least expect. I think we've become more comfortable assuming that our court system would let someone go free that is guilty rather than imprison someone who isn't guilty. I also think that true crime as a genre is very much geared toward making us believe that innocent people don't get arrested and put on trial, and any acquittals are simply travesties of the law, and as a result of someone having had a good defense lawyer or the prosecution not doing their job. I will admit to probably having had those biases myself at some point. The more I explore the type of case I'm presenting to you today, though, the more I realize that we need to approach all cases of crime and the accused and the perpetrators with a far more critical mindset. In researching today's case, I used the judgments from the appeal, a few media articles, and an episode of a series created by Drum Magazine. So let's get into episode 178, The Wrongful Conviction of Sibusiso Bulose.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Up front, I want to let you know that we have very little information about the victim who passed away in today's case. As you'll hear a little later, this has a lot to do with poor record keeping by the court. Of course, also, as you'll come to understand, there are several different types of victims in this case, and none of it is very clear-cut. Sibusiso Bulose was born and raised in Inanda, in KwaZulu-Natal. In recently released crime statistics, Inanda was rated as the second highest South African jurisdiction in terms of number of reported cases of violent crime. Inanda is a township in KwaZulu-Natal that is situated 21 kilometers northwest of Durban. Inanda Township is one of the oldest townships in the province. The area itself was initially, during the 17th century, the dwelling place of many local indigenous farmers. From then on, Inanda would be very much shaped by the Group Areas Act and local conflicts, evolving into its current iteration. Inanda is a historical place for a few reasons, besides how old it is. It is the birthplace of John Langalibalela Dube in 1887. Dube was the son of a respected Zulu clergyman, and his father's work with a local missionary station gave his son access to travel to the US to study. When Dube returned to Inanda, he opened several schools in the area, and most notably, started the South African Native National Congress, which would eventually evolve into the African National Congress, or ANC. On the 28th of February 1994, Nelson Mandela, who had recently been freed from incarceration, cast his first vote as a black South African in Inanda. He specifically chose to vote at a small station there because of the area's significance in the creation of the ANC, and it really being the birthplace of the struggle for freedom. Increasing levels of crime in the area are sadly a symptom of poor policing resources in townships, combined with the socioeconomic effect of poverty. Criminal gangs are rife in the area, and the vast majority of residents who were just trying to live their lives and survive from day to day live in fear and feel very little protection from police. I think that this background to the area is pretty important because the police members that are stationed there are stretched and I think often under deep pressure to quickly solve cases. When this happens, it often comes at a cost. And for at least one man, that cost would be almost two decades of his freedom. Sibusiso's entire world revolved around Inanda for the most part. He had three children with his long-term partner, but finances meant that they had to live in different parts of the area. Sibusiso lived with his mom, dad, and some of his siblings, but visited his partner and their children as often as possible when he wasn't working. I started out by telling you that there's very little information about the victims in this case, and in fact, there's so little information about the crime itself that I cannot even tell you exactly which day it happened on. Weird, right? Yeah, I thought so too. I can unfortunately only tell you that on a day in 2004, Sibusiso set off from home to visit his partner. Her brother had recently passed away, and the funeral was set to be held around that time, so he'd planned to stay over there for a while, help out with the arrangements, and spend some time with his partner and children. He'd had no idea how fateful this decision would be. On the evening that Sibusiso arrived, he was exhausted from all the chores around the house, so he'd gone to bed at 8 p.m. As the evening hours wore on, a few kilometers away from where he slept, three men set out on a criminal mission. The men were, among other things, car thieves, and they were looking for a car they could steal to use in other criminal activity. The car they ended up choosing belonged to a man called Mr. Mklengwa. It was parked directly outside his bedroom window. He would later testify that he'd woken up in the middle of the night to the sound of his car starting. He'd run outside and found a man in the driver's seat and two men in the back. He'd shouted at them, and the man in the driver's seat had gotten out of the car, pointed a gun at him, and told him they were taking his car. The man then fired a shot in Mr. Mklengwa's direction, which thankfully missed him, and he ran inside his house. His neighbour, Mr. Chebekulu, heard the ruckus and came running outside to investigate. He too was met with shouting, an armed man in the car, who didn't even hesitate to pull the trigger of the gun in his hand. A bullet hit Mr. Chebekulu in the stomach, and the man stumbled inside and collapsed in the doorway. His wife began to scream as she tried to stem the flow of blood from his wound, and their two teenage sons ran outside as well. Both boys were shot by the same attacker. One of the young men was shot in the back of his calf, and the other in the stomach. Finally, the criminals drove off in the car, leaving chaos and horror in their wake. Although the two Chebekulu boys survived their injuries, sadly, their father had lost too much blood too quickly, and he passed away before he could receive medical assistance. Police were on the scene relatively quickly, and after putting out a be on the lookout for Mr. Mklengwa's vehicle, the car was spotted soon after, and two occupants were arrested. The men claimed that they'd been handed the car by a man in the neighbourhood to sell, and denied having any knowledge of it having been procured by criminal means. To this day, Sibusiso is unsure when the first time was that his name came up, or how it even did. In what was likely a matter of half-truths and crossed lines, and two desperate men trying not to point their finger at their fellow gang member, who'd just proven he had no problem taking lives, Sibusiso's name was given to police, and at 8 p.m., they were at his partner's door. Sibusiso's partner had already gotten up to continue with funeral preparations, leaving him sleeping in bed, when he was awoken by banging and shouting at the door. He says that through his haze of sleep, it took him a little while to figure out what the shouting meant, and by the time he realized someone was shouting police, it was too late. The door came crashing in, and armed officers swarmed his bedroom. He describes the next half an hour of his life as utter confusion, chaos, and terror. The police officers screamed at him, talking about a murder and cuffing his hands before he knew what was happening. As soon as his hands were cuffed, the officers began beating him. As he tried to curl into the fetal position on his bed, He saw one of the officers walk over to a chest of drawers with an evidence bag in his hand. Sibusiso claims the officer pulled open a drawer, yanked something out of his pants, slid it into the drawer, and then shouted that he'd found a weapon, pulling out a gun and dropping it into the prepared evidence bag. As he called that out to his fellow officers, Sibusiso says the officers only began to hit him harder. They then dragged him outside and centered a few kicks into his stomach and back, right out in the open. Most of the neighbors who were out at that time turned their heads, not wanting to get involved, certain the police knew what they were doing. Kilometers away at Sibusiso's parents' home, his mother's phone rang. One person watching the display of brutality from the police had decided to do something. A friend of Sibusiso's phoned his mother and told her to come immediately as the police were killing her son. By the time the woman arrived there, Sibusiso had been taken away. For almost a week afterwards, Sibusiso's family tried desperately to find out where he was. He would explain that he was moved from station to station during this time. He'd been charged with one count of murder, two counts of attempted murder, robbery with aggravating circumstances, and unlawful possession of a firearm and ammunition. But no one could explain why he was being moved between so many police stations in KZN. Almost every day he was in a different set of holding cells. Finally, when his parents found him, he realized the police had wanted the injuries on his face to heal before he saw his parents. Sibusiso Bolose denied guilt from the first moment he was arrested. He told investigators that he was at home asleep that night, and although his partner had confirmed this, the police didn't seem to think that this was a valid enough alibi. Sibusiso says that he was never informed that he could have a lawyer present or seek legal advice. He had no money for a lawyer anyway, but eventually discovered from other awaiting trial prisoners that he could apply for a legal aid lawyer. 5 minutes before his bail hearing was due to start, a man walked up to Sibusiso and introduced himself as his lawyer. He asked him what his case was about, and the desperate man had less than 4 minutes to explain his case before they were called before a judge. With absolutely no preparation, the bail application was denied. It was during the bail hearing that Sibusiso heard for the first time that two other men had been arrested. The two men arrested inside the stolen vehicle were released without charge. And he also heard for the first time that police were claiming they'd found a gun in his room, and they were running ballistic tests, which would determine whether or not it was the murder weapon. Sibusiso was taken to Westville Prison and never saw that lawyer again. He learned from other awaiting trial inmates that he could expect to wait at least a year or two for his trial to start. He was horrified. How could it be? The state needed time to prepare its case, he was told. But as much as he asked, Sibusiso did not get access to a lawyer to start his preparations until about a week before trial proceedings were due to start. His fellow awaiting trialers had not been far off. It would take 2 full years before, in 2006, Sibusiso was moved to another prison without warning and told his trial would start in a week. A man in a suit showed up and introduced himself as his lawyer. Sibusiso says he didn't seem very interested in his version, nor the fact that he was actually innocent. By the time his trial started in the Durban High Court, Sibusiso was hopeful that he would not be found guilty. He knew there could be no evidence against him because he didn't commit the crime. The first witness to testify for the state was Mr. Mtlengwa, whose vehicle had been the target of the theft. The man had looked the shooter in the eye and faced him as he shouted at him to stop, and then the man had fired a shot at him. After testifying about what had happened, Mr. Mklengwa was asked whether he could identify the man who'd stolen his vehicle and shot at him. The man said he would be able to identify him if he saw him again. He was then asked if he saw the man in the courtroom that day. After taking a moment to study the faces of the few people in the gallery, and then those closer to him, including Sibusiso Bolose, Mr. Mklengwa said the man who'd stolen his car and shot at him was not in the courtroom that day. When the first Chebekulu teen was called to testify, he spoke about the injuries he'd sustained and how he'd sat beside his father as he bled to death on the ground. He told the court that he could not see his attacker's face. It was too dark, and everything had happened so quickly. He'd been shot almost as soon as he'd stepped outside the door and had then collapsed back inside. When his brother took the stand, though, he insisted that he had looked his attacker in the face and he'd been looking at him as he was shot. To Sibusiso's horror, the young man then claimed that his attacker was Sibusiso Bolose. The young man was clearly traumatized on the stand, taking regular breaks to be able to continue. Finally, in cross-examination, Sibusiso's lawyer asked the young man where he'd been shot. He replied that the bullet had entered the back of his calf. The lawyer asked how it was possible that he could be shot in the back of his body if he claimed that he was facing his attacker when he was shot. The young man had no explanation. The boy's mother and Mr. Chebekulu's wife also took the stand. The woman's deep grief was etched on her face. In one night, she had almost had her entire family wiped out by one man, and she, like her son, seemed convinced that that man was Sibusiso Bolose. Several inconsistencies in testimony would be raised in cross-examination. There was almost no lighting near the house in Inanda where the crime had occurred. The lawyer insisted that it would have been impossible for anyone to positively identify the shooter in the dark with bullets flying. Then something else emerged. The Chebekulus had known Sibusiso from before this day in court. They knew him from the neighborhood. Sibusiso's mom ran a small business as a meat vendor, and her son often helped her with sales. Over and again, Mrs. Chebekulu and her son were asked in different ways if they had actually seen Sibusiso that night, or if they'd just seen someone who looked like him, and their memories had adjusted the actual face of the perpetrator into someone they knew from somewhere else. And once the two men were caught, and somehow Sibusiso's name got into the mix, could it be possible, they were asked, that they'd put two and two together and got five? Finally, before she left the stand, Mrs. Chebekulu was asked whether she'd heard the voice of her husband's murderer that night. She said she had, when he'd shouted at her husband to stay back before almost immediately shooting him. Then they asked her if she had heard Sibusiso Bolose's voice. She said she had. The defense lawyer asked the woman if the two voices were the same. She hesitated. No, she said, they weren't the same voices. The story behind Sibusiso's arrest, as told by one of the officers present that day, was very different to what the arrestee himself knew had happened. The officer claimed that they'd found Sibusiso hiding in a cupboard with a gun in his hand. He denied ever having assaulted or having witnessed an assault of Sibusiso and said that he'd wrestled the gun out of his hands and then handcuffed him and led him away. Sibusiso still had the scars on his face from the assault. Ordinarily, when an individual is arrested in a murder case, they'll be taken to a state-appointed doctor so that any injuries or marks on their bodies can be recorded. Photographs are ordinarily taken at this time as well. This helps not only to record evidence of any defensive wounds a victim may have inflicted on their attacker, but also to record tattoos and other identifying marks. In addition, it protects police from spurious claims of assault from accused persons. Sibusiso never saw a doctor on his arrest, nor were any photographs taken of his body. When the ballistics officer took the stand, Sibusiso's stomach clenched with anxiety. He knew that the gun they'd claimed to have found in his house was not his, and he hoped this could be shown through the evidence that was about to be presented. Firstly, the ballistics officer testified that the weapon allegedly found in Sibusiso's room was not the weapon used to shoot Mr. Chebekulu or his sons. It was a 9mm, the same caliber, but the variation of bullets was wrong, with the gun found being a 9mm short, while those having been recovered from the victims was a 9mm long. In addition, the striations and other markings used to compare bullets fired from this firearm to the bullets recovered from the crime scene didn't match. Crucially, although it had been claimed that Sibusiso had been found clutching the gun, when the forensics officers testified, no fingerprints were found on the gun at all. It had also not been fired recently. By the time both the state and the defense had rested, it seemed very clear to Sibusiso, at least, that there was very little solid evidence pointing in his direction. He had an alibi, although the state had implied his partner was lying to assist him. There was no physical evidence connecting him to the crime, and he had no history of violent crime or any connections to criminal gangs. The gun found was not the murder weapon, and the two witnesses who'd claimed to have identified him as the shooter had given shaky testimony at best. The two men who'd been found in the car had never been called to testify that Sibusiso had been the man who'd given them the vehicle, and there was no forensic link inside the vehicle to Sibusiso either. Despite all of this, when the judge handed down his sentence, Sibusiso Bolose was crushed. He'd been found guilty of all the charges against him, and he was handed down a life sentence for the murder of Mr. Chebekulu, plus additional years for the other charges. As he began serving his sentence in Westville Prison, Sibusiso almost immediately started looking into the possibility of appeal. He would soon discover, though, that the struggle he'd endured to get assistance from legal aid for his trial would be nothing compared to the difficulty of getting them on board for an appeal. He wrote letter after letter for years with no response. On the outside, life continued. Sibusiso's father passed away while he was incarcerated, as did several other family members. His mother struggled financially and eventually suffered a stroke. She was able to recover enough to be able to still care for herself around the house, but all of this and the financial difficulties made it almost impossible for her to regularly visit Sibusiso in prison. His friends had all cast him aside, believing that he'd been hiding this dark side as a criminal and murderer from them, and he'd become almost completely cut off from the world. By 2013, Sibusiso Bolose had spent almost a decade in prison for a crime he did not commit, and he eventually realized that he was not going to get any help from legal aid. The only way out was going to be for him to somehow try and fund a private lawyer. During a rare conversation with his mother, Sibusiso mentioned that this would have to be a route he'd have to follow. They briefly discussed ways they could possibly raise enough money to get a private criminal lawyer on retainer. The call ended with little hope. His mother could barely afford the transport money to travel to see him. Tens of thousands of rands seemed completely out of sight. But Sibusiso's mother had a plan. Through talking to friends, she'd been introduced to a man who privately lent out money. He was a loan shark, essentially, and the terms of his loans were insane and predatory. But the woman saw no other choice. She had to get her son out of prison. And so the desperate mother took a 25,000 rand loan from the loan shark and started looking for a lawyer. Tabani Mpongose was horrified, but not entirely surprised, when he heard the circumstances of Sibusiso's conviction. He knew that Legal Aid had many excellent lawyers, but with the vast majority of people being accused of crimes not having access to private lawyers, the organization was also completely overwhelmed with first-time trials alone. Appeals was simply an added burden they could not carry. Having practiced law in KwaZulu-Natal for many years, Mpungose was also not entirely surprised at Sibusiso's claims about the unethical and blatantly illegal actions of the police. I have also seen an alarming number of cases and claims against police, particularly in the more dangerous areas of KZN. There are many claims of brutality, evidence planting, and corruption from some members of the SAPS there. If Sibusiso's claim of the police officer having planted a gun in his house sounds wild and unbelievable to you, I will tell you that I have a recorded interview with a mother whose 16-year-old son was murdered by police in KZN. And when they realized they'd shot the wrong person, several members of her family witnessed police planting a gun in the cushions of the couch the boy had been sleeping on when he was shot by police. That case is ongoing, and I'll share more information about it with you in a separate episode at some point. But this is the other side that we rarely think about and seldom see brought to light. But it is happening to innocent people, and I have little doubt it happened to Sibusiso Bulose. With a dedicated lawyer on his case, Sibusiso finally started to see progress, but the hurdles were far from covered. Tabani Mpongose's first port of call was to pull the transcripts of Sibusiso's trial so that he could start analysing the case firsthand and see how best to structure the appeal. But that simple act presented the first obstruction. There was no transcript. There was absolutely no record of Sibusiso Bulose's trial. This transcript is vital not just to the preparation of the appeal by the defence, but the appeal itself, because the appeal court does not hear the entire trial and all the evidence again. They look to the transcript to educate themselves on the facts of the case and to see whether any procedural errors or errors in law may have occurred. So essentially, the absence of a transcript completely voids the rights of the convicted person to the appeals available to them by law. Mpongose brought this to the attention of the appeal court, and the participants in the trial, including the prosecutor, legal aid lawyer, and judge, were ordered to cooperate and put together a comprehensive reconstruction of the record. Although this was a step in the right direction, it would only add to the delay in getting to the actual appeal. In fact, it would take another 6 years for this process to be completed. And by the time the reconstructed record was finally presented to an appeal court, it was found wanting. In 2020, an appeal court looked at the record that had been placed before them and decided that it was nowhere near comprehensive enough for them to make a decision on appeal based on it. And that fact alone meant that they had no choice but to accept Sibusiso's appeal and grant a full reversal of both the conviction and the sentence. The information was also ordered to be removed from his record. After 16 years in prison, Sibusiso Bolose was a free man. Although his freedom is what he wanted, in principle, Sibusiso was not entirely happy with the reason for his appeal being granted. The appeal outcome stated that his conviction and sentence were being vacated because the record of the trial was not available, which was a procedural issue, and not necessarily because he was not guilty of the crimes. That bothered Sibusiso, because it felt like he'd been released on a technicality, and he wanted a piece of paper to say that he should never have been found guilty in the first place. After his release, a few media houses covered Sibusiso's story. All referred to his case as one of wrongful conviction, as I have done in the title of this episode. But the NPA took exception to that. A month after Sibusiso was released, the NPA released a statement admonishing the media for framing the man's conviction as wrongful and clarifying that he was only released because there was no record of the original trial. This only served to worsen Sibusiso's experience because now his neighbours and community, who were already suspicious and had believed for 16 years that the Bolose man from that house over there was a murderer, were seeing reports that he was actually only released because of some paperwork and not necessarily because he wasn't guilty. So why did I choose to label this episode the wrongful conviction of Sibusiso Bolose, despite the NPA's claim that this is not technically true? Well, because I'd very much like the NPA to prove it's not true. On the balance of probabilities, from the evidence that appears to exist, and comparing this to other similar cases which have been proven to be wrongful convictions, I do not believe Sibusiso Bolose committed this crime, and even that aside, it certainly does not appear that there was nearly enough evidence to secure a legal conviction. You may be wondering why police would bother to plant a gun in the house of someone they're arresting when they know that gun won't be linked to the crime. What value would it hold? Well, firstly, the presence of that gun did end up securing criminal charges against Sibusiso. He was charged and found guilty of the illegal possession of that gun and the ammunition inside it. But it also goes to creating the impression that Sibusiso is a gun-toting criminal. The thought process could be, well, he may not have had the murder weapon, but he had a gun, and therefore that means he must be capable of the crimes he is accused of. While I would expect something like that not to influence the actual judge, we can't say that some bias doesn't exist even there. But certainly it could have influenced witnesses' thought processes. The human brain is a powerful and amazing thing. And it's also still pretty mysterious for the most part. We still don't exactly know how a lot of our cognitive processes work, and how deeply, for instance, memory can be influenced and suggestion and bias can impact our recall of an event. There's absolutely no doubt that the Chebekulu family suffered a deeply traumatic event on the night three of their members were shot and their father and husband was murdered. They would have desperately wanted to get justice, and understandably so. So perhaps it would not have been difficult for them to come to the conclusion that the shooter whose face was shrouded in darkness, and whose face looked somewhat like Sibusiso Bolose, could have been the young man they knew from the neighbourhood. Of course, they only came to this conclusion after he was arrested. They did not tell police that night that they'd recognized the shooter as someone they knew. Only after the suggestion was placed to them, albeit inadvertently, by Sibu Sisu's arrest, that he was the one, did their brains start to put the right pieces together along with the wrong pieces and form a puzzle that fits in their minds but didn't actually fit the truth? And then, when that young man was found with an illegal firearm in his possession, well, that was just more proof that he was a criminal. And that may have further cemented in their minds that they must have seen Sibu Sisu Bolose holding a gun that night. The only real evidence against Sibu Sisu in the trial were two half-sure testimonies from two incredibly traumatized people. So, is it fair to say Sibu Sisu Bolose was wrongfully convicted? Yes, I believe it is. In the comments of almost every report I see on a wrongful conviction, including Sibu Sisu's, I see people saying, well, he's going to be a rich man now because the state has to compensate him. And that is sadly not the case. There is no allowance in South African law for immediate consideration for compensation when someone is wrongfully convicted. In fact, it's actually incredibly difficult, and for the most part, almost impossible for most people to achieve. In South Africa, compensation for wrongful conviction and or imprisonment can only be attained through a civil claim under the law of delict. Essentially, a wrongfully convicted person who has been released has to have the private resources to launch a civil court case against the government department who they believe was responsible for their wrongful conviction. It becomes the wrongfully convicted person's responsibility to prove their case, rather than it being automatically accepted that the mere fact that their conviction has been vacated is proof that they were wronged. The law of delict requires that you prove that an individual who was a representative of a department carried out specific actions which you can identify and attest to that directly led to you being convicted when you were not guilty. Sure, if you win, you can ask to claim your costs back from the respondent, but that could take years. And if you're just an ordinary individual, where do you get the money to launch a complicated court case against a huge department with legal resources of their own on staff? The simple answer is, you don't. This issue is a gaping hole in our otherwise mostly well-constructed constitution and needs to be addressed immediately. One paper I read on this issue intimates that South Africa is actually in contravention of an international justice treaty we're party to because we have not put measures in place to allow easy access to compensation for wrongful convictions. Of course, there are and should be exceptions to this. Not every person whose sentence or conviction is overturned on appeal is innocent. Very occasionally, there are severe procedural issues which crop up that result in people successfully appealing when they are actually guilty of the crime. And that is incredibly sad and unfair. But it's also going to happen occasionally when we have a healthy and robust legal system. All countries that have automatic access to compensation for wrongful convictions have conditions on this, which must be met. But the onus and the responsibility remains on the state or the department to navigate that, and not for someone who's had 16 years of their life stolen and has no access to any type of financial resources to try and access. So for now, Sibu Sisu Bolose and every other wrongfully convicted person sits and waits in the hope that one day the law will change or some kind lawyer will put their hand up and go up against the state in court pro bono. Of course, there's nothing stopping the state from offering this compensation without being sued in cases where it's clearly the fair thing to do. I'm not aware of any such instances yet, though, and I won't be holding my breath either. I'll link the academic paper I read about the wrongful conviction compensation situation in the show notes, if you'd like to read more about that. You may be wondering, after I mentioned the police's action in planting the gun in Sibusiso's home, and just the general, clearly targeted investigation against him, what would these police officers gain out of doing this? Well, I guess there's a few ways. The most obvious way a police officer could gain through fabricating evidence is financially, if they're being paid off to do so. Now, there's no proof that that happened in Sibusiso's case, and it's probably unlikely because his arrest happened so soon after the murder. But it is possible the gang that committed this murder had just generally paid off some police officers to cover their tracks. But it remains an outlying possibility, in my opinion. The other way they could gain is simply by solving the case to begin with. Police officers are largely measured on the number of cases they close. And please note that closed does not mean solved. So the faster they can bring a case to a close and attain an arrest, the better they look. And of course, there's another side to this too. Sometimes police officers get into this mindset where they'll push boundaries when they think it's fair to do so, even though it's against the law. So when they've decided someone is guilty, they may plant, guide, or manipulate evidence to escalate the chances of that person being found guilty. It's an incredibly dangerous form of tunnel vision, and I've heard several cases of this happening both locally and internationally. And I think there's an extra layer to this when police officers work in very high crime areas. Every single day, they're in contact with criminals and have their own lives on the line. And I think that can very quickly, with the right or wrong base mentality, develop into this hero complex where they feel it's their place to play judge and jury, so to speak. Sibusiso Bolose went into prison as a 28-year-old man with a future ahead of him. He came out as a 44-year-old man. And although he still has time to live a good life, it has been made far more difficult by the fact that he lost those 16 years in which he could have built a business, worked on a career, and helped his family. He also lost something which he can never get back. 16 years with his children. He went in as a father and came out as a grandfather, meeting his grandchild for the first time when they were already a toddler. He missed matriculations and weddings and funerals. None of that can be regained, no matter how much compensation is paid to him. But money certainly would help to build a bridge into a new life for him and his family. On the other side of this tragedy is the Chebekulu family, and the deep grief they faced, combined with the confusion, fear, and uncertainty of hearing that the man they believed was their father's killer was, in fact, not the right person after all. And the real killer has been out on the streets all this time. And who knows how many more people he's killed since then. Cases like this force me to look at the side of justice I don't often consider. I always want to focus on the victim's experience. But in a case like this, the victims are not just the people who lost someone or their own lives. I do still believe that the vast majority of convictions are fair and just. But even when one person spends a single day in prison for something they didn't do, it's too much, in my opinion. And if someone can get wrongfully convicted and sentenced to life, for something as serious as murder, that strongly brings into question whether we really should have any harsher sentences than that. What if we'd put Sibusiso Bolose to death? Cases like this also bring to the fore how deeply connected justice is with privilege. As much as we might not like to think about it, justice is clearly not the same for all in any country. Money buys you access to attorneys who can clear their entire schedule and focus solely on your case. It buys you experts who can re-examine evidence and present alternate theories. Sometimes, it buys you the luxury of being out on bail rather than waiting for 2 years for a trial to start in severely overcrowded prison environments, which are not only uncomfortable, but also incredibly violent, and almost guaranteed to have you leaving with far more trauma than you arrived with, even if you aren't convicted at trial. Recently, it was announced that the Justice Department is looking at having a fund created to which accused persons can apply for assistance with bail money. Bail amounts are usually supposed to be based on the means available to the individual, but often even 1,000 rand is simply unattainable for some. And looking at a case like Sibusiso's, if he'd been able to get bail, he may have had a better chance of communicating with his lawyers and not being convicted in the first place. I think we've become quite hardened to the plight of the accused and convicted persons in South Africa because we experience such high levels of crime. And we often feel that once you're convicted of a crime, you shouldn't have any rights at all. And that thinking often extends to accused persons, despite them being innocent until proven guilty. But I think situations like Sibusiso's need to make us sit back and consider who might be suffering as a result of us wanting to refuse accused persons and offenders their rights, because it might not always be a guilty person. I was quite surprised a while back to learn exactly how qualification for legal aid works, and I think it might surprise some of you too. I guess I'd always figured that if you got arrested and were charged with something, and you couldn't afford a lawyer, you could just say so and one would be appointed for you. That's what we always hear on TV, right? But no, that's not how it works. You have to prove you can't afford a lawyer, which is fair enough, I guess, because you can't have people just unnecessarily putting pressure on the legal aid system. But it's more the threshold that amazed me. In order to qualify for a legal aid attorney in South Africa, you have to earn less than 8,700 rand a month. So if you're sitting there and listening to this and you earn, let's say, 20,000 rand a month, but we all know a lot of that goes to rent, kids if you have them, food, petrol, and the list is endless. Very few people are actually able to save money every month for incidentals. But know this. If you're arrested and charged for a crime you didn't commit, and you have to go to trial, you will have to fund your own lawyer. On average, criminal defense counsel in South Africa charge anywhere between 900 rand and 2,500 rand per hour. I don't know about you, but I don't have that kind of money sitting around. So, you might find yourself in an even worse position than Sibusiso, with no lawyer at all, or one you've had to pay for by indebting yourself to the hilt. But that will never happen to me, you say. I would never put myself in a position where I'd be accused of that. Okay, well, neither did Sibusiso. Sibusiso's greatest crime was looking sort of like a murderer and being asleep in his bed when a murder occurred. That's all he did. And he lost 16 years of his life for it. It is very clear to me that an urgent change in legislation is required around wrongful convictions in this country. Perhaps once the State Department's involved are forced to pay up a few times, they'll be less likely to heavy-handedly push through convictions in the future. It's also very clear that legal aid is as under-resourced as many other departments, and people are paying for it with decades of their lives. It should not take an elderly woman indebting herself to loan sharks for a convicted person to have access to their rightful appeal process. Yes, I know appeals are an annoyance when we know the person is guilty, but they are there for this exact reason, because we don't always get it right. But if it takes a decade to access those allowed appeals, there's something very broken in the system, not just for the offender, but also for the victims of the crime. Why should they suddenly wake up 10 years later and find out the person they thought murdered their loved one is in an appeal process? This should all happen as quickly after the initial trial as possible. After all, the trial itself is already an unnecessarily long process. Even if the record of Sibusiso's initial trial was available, I still believe he would have had his conviction and sentence reversed. But the fact that the record was not available and could not be properly reconstructed because no other valid records existed, and that's the reason he was released, is actually terrifying. Because what if that happens in a case where someone is guilty? What if just by chance, a really heinous murderer decides to push an appeal on the off chance they'll get something out of it, and they can't find the record of their trial? These are the two-sided impacts of this type of inefficiency that can quite honestly be lethal to future victims. I know as true crime consumers, we predominantly want to hear about cases where justice was done and the bad guy got locked up and everything was neatly tied up with a bow. But if we are to be ethical consumers of this type of content, we have to be open to the possibility that this is not always the case. Sometimes the bad guy is the justice system. Sometimes the good guy gets locked up. And the other bad guy gets away and probably does it again. And the victims of the crimes just get left in limbo. And there's really nothing that stops this from happening to you. Mr. Chebekulu, rest gently. Sibusiso Bolose, I hope the rest of your life is lived embracing the freedom you deserved, and that one day you are compensated for all that you lost. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Lived Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.